Talk given Sunday, 27th July, 1975.
Let us begin today by inquiring whom does the world call a man of vision, and what is the meaning of the term a man of vision in the religious sense? In order to understand this clearly, and there is a world of difference between the two, we must bear in mind that the man of the world is fairly and squarely self-oriented. He is aware of himself as a separate individual from everyone and everything else. He is conscious of his existence from the time there is the dawning of consciousness in him after birth till the day of his death. He is conscious of existence in terms of I and the world, two things which are separate. In the course of his life, he also comes to realize that he is not the one and only pebble on the beach. And therefore, there are relationships between himself and those with whom he comes in contact, and with the world, generally speaking. But his awareness, his consciousness, is always in terms of myself, and everything outside this body is separate from me, is different from me. As and when he truly loves, whether it be his family or his friends or anything, he is aware in a deeper sense in terms of us and not exclusively in terms of myself. But that is rather rare. Right in the depths of his consciousness, even in relation to those whom he cares for, there is still the overriding awareness that I am I, she is she, he is he, and so there is this separation. It is easy to talk of this. It is easy for the intellect to just look at it at a distance, superficially, and say, yes, this is so, and then take no further notice of it. The consequence is that this man of the world is a separatist. He is always a divider. He is divided within himself, and he is divided from the rest of the universe. Therefore, there is always conflict. There is always the urge towards dominating his environment, his situation. Success and fulfillment for himself, if unavoidable, at the cost of others. For such a person, and practically all the 4,000 millions of the world today are like that, for such a person, vision means that which will bring me the fulfillment of heart's desire, ambitions, whatever form they take. They may take apparently altruistic forms, but that altruism has selfness at the core of it, an ineradicable selfness. Therefore, his whole life is circumscribed within the sphere of duality, of ambivalence, and therefore of a condition which is not fully human. It is subhuman. For the man of vision of that sort, conquest, achievement, attainment, gain, and all the rest of it, all the trumpery stuff of the world, means a vision and fulfilling vision. All the great conquerors, the successful unhung pirates, unhanged I should say, yes, to be correct, and so forth, as well as the philanthropists and others, they are all called men of vision. But you see, their outlook is a self-oriented outlook. Therefore, all their activity, all that they achieve, as we say, has this canker of selfness somewhere in all that they do and they achieve. And it is this which brings about destruction in course of time. Death. All this comes within the sphere of the Lord of Death. It does not undergo transformation through the centuries along those lines which represent what we term life eternal or life abundant. They are, in their inner nature, something which must of necessity die, perish. And in that dying and perishing, there is pain, there is loss, there is harm to those who are living. I presented rather a critical, almost gloomy picture of the worldly man of vision. But we must face facts. If we wish to be religious, then there is no point in refusing to see or condoning or trying to excuse that which is essentially irreligious. The religious consciousness is concerned with totality. It is transcendent. Transcendent in the sense that it is something so all-inclusive, including ourselves too, that each one of us can never visualize it, picture it, imagine it, think of it, define it in its completeness. That's totally impossible. It is everlastingly the mysterious unknown and the unknowable. But we can sense it. We can sense it. And if we sense it with sufficient intensity, then the intellect will be able to see a little more clearly and tell us certain fundamental things, such as that it is the unknown and the unknowable in its totality. A fraction of it comes through into our lives, and it may come to full fruition in our individual lives, in which case such people are the great spiritual lights of the world. They are remembered as the founders of great religions and so forth, not as the promulgators of a new philosophy of life. Do remember that. But those whose whole life was the embodiment of the living truth, the living truth about man, his nature, and his fulfillment. And therefore, what they teach, what they try to express through life, is expressed in terms, as the consequence of the vision which is the truly human vision, and as such, therefore, is identical with what we may rightly call the divine vision. We must not mistake the use of the word divine in this context. There is no suggestion that the term divine vision refers to some extraneous entity called God, with whom one mysteriously has some communication. Any entity which is described and named God, or the transcendent, or Brahman, or Atma, or Allah, or Ramazda, any such entity is only a projection out of our own imperfect minds. And the simplest evidence of this is the fact that when you yourself are sensitive enough to become aware of the reality of transcendence, one of the first things you become aware of is that transcendence is no entity. Entity is born, it comes into being, it proceeds, it lives, as we say, and it inevitably dies. All entity, all that is describable, comes within the sphere of birth and death, that which is born and lives and dies. So transcendence, the one total reality, is the everlasting, the immortal, that which was not born, therefore, and cannot die, therefore. We can predicate nothing about it in the sense that our predication will be an accurate description of it. Consider, when we use terms like immortality, eternity, absoluteness, these terms have no meaning, no defined, no specific definite meaning. What do we mean by eternity? And yet we sense it, don't we? There is something which we sense to which we give the name eternity. And that sensing is not an illusion. If it were an illusion, then through the millennia that have gone past, that illusion could easily have been wiped out. But we all use that word. We all use the word transcendent, transcendence. We all use the word God, which we have entitized, to use an ugly term, more than any other word, and thereby spoilt the reality of God. So now, the man of vision, from the religious point of view, in the religious sense, is someone who is a rarity in the world. Truly a rarity. There is one thing in this connection which we might consider with profit today. The man of vision, in the religious sense, is one, if he is the fully grown man of vision, he is the man who is capable of total attentiveness. We have used this phrase again and again, being totally attentive, wholly attentive, just as we have used that other phrase, the one total reality, again and again. A few weeks ago, we considered some of the significances and implications of that phrase, the one total reality. Let us consider some of the significances associated with total attentiveness. What sort of attentiveness are we here capable of? Can we be totally attentive? Are we in fact at all attentive in the profound, fully human, the religious sense of the word? Just let's consider what we mean by being attentive. In the ordinary way, when we are at school, for instance, and the teacher sees that we are staring out of the window, he tells us, "Brown, pay attention to what's going on." And Brown suddenly wakes up with a start and says, "Yes, sir." Goodness knows what he says under his breath, but that's another matter. And he is supposed, let us assume now, he starts paying attention. What is he doing actually? There he is sitting and listening to the words of the teacher or what he is writing on the blackboard or whatever it may be. When the teacher speaks, he speaks in a language which the pupil understands, or is supposed to understand. As the teacher speaks, what is the pupil doing? He is interpreting all that the teacher says. How does this interpretive process take place? Because this is the crux of the matter. The pupil, from his childhood, has been brought up in a certain way, characterized essentially in the beginning by the reception of sense impressions to which names are given. The little infant begins to recognize its mother and says, "Mum, mum, mum." And the sound "mum" stands for the mother, and "dad" stands for the father, and "doggy" stands for the little plaything that he plays with, and so forth and so forth. The names are given. So this system of symbolical sounds is associated with a complex of sense impressions. As the child grows older, this system of symbolical sounds is set into patterns, sentences, and a collection of sentences makes up a large pattern, the story, or the description, or the expression of what the child wants, etc., etc. Now, this is how the child is being conditioned, mentally conditioned. The idea whether this type of conditioning is absolutely true to the actuality of the things or persons from whom come those stimuli which form these sense impressions in the child is never questioned. It's never challenged. A child looks at its parent and says, "Oh, that's Dad." But what precisely is in the child's mind with respect to Dad? Does the child seeing Dad really know Dad? He doesn't. There is just an impression. So now, this type of mind is the sort of mind which we all have in the course of our growing up. So when the child pays attention to the teacher's words, the teacher and the words are something quite separate from me, the pupil, and I interpret what he says according to my conditioning. And this is what I generally mean by paying attention. There is this strong awareness of self. I, the pupil, am listening to that other fellow, the teacher. Now you see, there's a separation between the two. There's a big gulf between the two. And this is what we call attentiveness. In a sense, it is. In the worldly sense, it is. But is this real attentiveness, or is there something else? Now, this is where the difference comes between attentiveness in the worldly sense and attentiveness in the fully human sense. If one can attend in such manner that there is no separation in consciousness between the object of attention and the subject who is attending, then attentiveness is total and complete. Now you see the implications of that. All my conditioning is out of the picture. All my conditioning distorts, misinterprets that which is coming to me. I only obtain a confused, my reception is a confused thing in the ordinary way. In this way, there is no confusion. Then, when I look at you, I see you as you actually are. Because there is no self-consciousness interfering with the act of seeing. And with the disappearance of that separative self-consciousness, all the conditioning factors are out. Now, if the conditioning factors are out, then that sort of seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, feeling, thinking is utterly different, indescribably different from our ordinary seeing, hearing, touching, and so forth. It's indescribably different. There is complete wholeness in that seeing and listening. There is no reactivity from my brain whilst I'm seeing or hearing to the other person or thing. For instance, when you're listening to me, your brain is all the time either agreeing or disagreeing or feels perplexed or has reactions constantly coming out. Isn't that so? But this is inattentiveness in the real sense. Take an ordinary experience in life, something which is universal to mankind. When you really care for a person and you are in his or her presence, your whole attention goes out to that other without anything to separate the two of you. Your all attention to that person. This is not the whole thing in the supreme human religious sense, but it comes nearest to it. It is indescribable, especially in this respect, that the sense of separateness from the person you care for is completely out. There is a very definite overriding consciousness of us as one whole. If that kind of consciousness functioned continuously within oneself with respect to the whole world, then one is totally attentive all the time. There is no reaction against the world. There is no reaction for the world. If they are neither for nor against, and you are unself-conscious, therefore not indifferent, just aloof and standing apart, you are in total communion, aren't you? And it is in this state of being in total communion that you are totally attentive. This is one of the deep significances of total attentiveness. That it is the living expression of transcendent love as well as transcendent wisdom and purity. The impure person cannot be totally attentive. Because every impurity is an actual living influence within one's own psyche, which clouds the act of seeing, hearing, touching, and so forth, and spoils it. You know, these things are so big, they are so deep, that to try to conceive of them in precise terms is impossible in the first instance. And secondly, in the second instance, it is a mistake to try to do so. This is something which cannot be perceived intellectually, because all intellectual perception implies holding at a distance. It's like seeing with the eyes. Can I see my own face with my eyes? I can't. But there is this other aspect of the mind. We often use the term heart in this connection. This feeling aspect. The mind sees, the intellect sees, as if with the eyes, that which is at a distance. But the heart, which is another word for the mind, actually, in this context, the heart feels it. The mind touches that which it is becoming aware of. It touches it. It holds it within itself. When the two take place together, in harmony, you, the individual being, are definitely aware of this total attentiveness, in terms of total attentiveness. Now, what are some of the characteristics of this kind of attentiveness? It is utterly empty of the influence of the past. The whole of the past has no distorting influence upon this kind of attentiveness. How are we, as we are, conscious of the past? Only in terms of fixed mental constructs, concepts, as we call them, terms of concepts. But a concept is a fixture. Now, a concept is necessary for everyday ordinary living, because without the concept, you cannot possibly structure, give structure to that which you are perceiving in the immediate now. You can't do it. It is your concept which enables you, when you see that object there, to say, yes, that's a piano, that's a book. If you did not have the concept built up, the fixed concept built up, recognition cannot take place. The first perception, which is also the first cognition without any power to retain that which it has cognized, just comes and goes like that, in the beginning, so to say. The multiplication of the percepts of the same object gradually builds up a concept in the mind. And this concept is the thing that enables recognition to take place. But the trouble is this: the concept pushes out the feeling aspect. So that in the immediate living now, when you look, when you hear, when you touch, when you feel, when you think, if the concept works this way, it destroys the possibility of true communion. And if the possibility of true communion is not present, then total attentiveness is also absent. Look at it again the other way, which I suggested a few moments ago. In total attentiveness, there is no influence of the whole of the past. But now let us not be deceived, therefore, that you can just sort of dispense with the past. We cannot dispense with the past. Why? Because consider, what is the immediate now? The immediate present. The immediate present is the living representative of the total past as it transformed. Whatsoever is at the moment is continuously being alive, it is continuously transforming. But from moment to moment, each transformation as it took place, supposing you could photograph it, all those photographs are stills. You see, they are fixations, aren't they? They tell you a connected story, if you like, and this story implies time unidirectionally. But in each of these stills, in that single moment of time, the whole of eternity is embodied. Eternity rides on the wings of time, as I've said now and again. This is what it means. And this transforming process in this immediate moment now, here now, is all alive. The whole of what we call the dead past is totally alive in the immediate now. Not in the shape of the past, but in this which actually is present now, the transformed state. In total attentiveness then, you're attending to the now, and in that attention to the now, in any particular finite form or person or anything, because it embodies the whole of the past, it embodies the whole of the world, the whole of the universe there, and you are awake to it. Not in descriptive terms, bear that in mind. In terms of this sensitivity of which we sometimes call consciousness, which we sometimes call awareness, which utterly transcends all the limitations of thought and speech. This is a meaning of the omniscience of God. All the theologies have talked of God as being omniscient. Not only the theologies, but the religious teachings which have emanated in consequence of any particular founder's teachings, they claim omniscience for their founder. The perfect yogi is the omniscient one, they say. That does not mean that he is a transcendent super encyclopedia walking about. He is not. He'd definitely burst if he were to attempt to be that sort of encyclopedia. No, it has nothing to do with acquired knowledge. It has everything to do with a mode of awareness. That mode of awareness which is associated with complete communion. And it is something transcendent. It has none of the limitations that we experience here. So the whole of that past is embodied in the living now. And if you pay total attention, if you can pay total attention in the living now, it means that all conditions of evil, of sin, sin meaning the divided state, that is its first meaning. We can never repeat this too often. The word sin fundamentally means to try and break up or spoil the unity of the universe. Whatsoever disunites is sin. See, no evil, no sin is present, therefore, in that total attentiveness. And if so, there is no such thing as the generation of karma in the sense, in the rather pathetic, misguided sense in which it is used by millions and millions of people, as a system of retribution, of reward and punishment. That is childish nonsense. This reward and punishment business has unfortunately come through the ages because human beings have been unable to appreciate that the whole living process of the entire universe is a transforming process. The moment-to-moment transformation means that the forces which were operating in the previous moment have now produced this. That is what we call reward, punishment, are all involved in that transforming. There is nothing left over. It's a moment-to-moment transformation. And you see the futility of this retributive idea. And if you see the futility and nonsense of this sort of idea, you will also see that all the heavens and hells in a hereafter and so forth, which have been invented by theologians, are all nonsense, sheer nonsense. Karma is not a ledger account of debits and credits. There is no such thing. The living process is a process of transformation, and the thing works out from instant to instant. It is I who am so limited, so short-sighted, so small in actual fact, that it is impossible for me to see precisely how this is all worked out. But one can get hold of the general principle, the general fact. And when you get hold of it, when you really understand it, what a burden, what a load falls off your shoulders. The fears and the terrors and the uncertainties and confusions and all the vain conjectures and all the false inventions about, oh, past lives you did this and that and therefore in this life this is happening. Good God, said God, what a job I've got. For heaven's sake, for your own sake, just use a little bit of good sense. And put a blue pencil through all the nonsense. The real meaning of karma, if you want to find out real meanings, look into the origin of the word itself. From karma, from kri. Karma means action. Derived from kri, meaning to create. What has creation got to do with ledger accounts of debits and credits? Nothing at all. Absolutely nothing at all. If you think it has, you haven't begun to understand the meaning of the word creation. What we do know in ordinary life is procreation, not real creation. Procreation means the coming into being true to type. Human beings produce other human beings. From oak trees, the acorns, other oak trees are produced. Not pigs or mosquitoes or rock stones or diamonds. true to type. Grass will produce grass, and so forth and so forth, you see? And it all lies within its limited context. This is procreation. When a human being writes poetry, produces symphonies, carves wonderful statues, builds buildings, that is cultural, intellectual, emotional procreation. It's true to type. You recognize a symphony because, being true to type, it will be thus and thus in its form and content and so forth. But creation is that which is utterly new. The unknown manifesting something utterly new. It is non-repetitive. Procreation is repetitive. Through the generations, human beings produce human beings, tigers produce tigers, and so forth. You see the difference? So, in total attentiveness, you are in that plane of creation. The first and fundamental and the supreme meaning of karma. And if you really touch that, you will see that it is acausal. There's no cause-effect linkage involved in it. It is amoral. It's not immoral. Don't you believe that? It is utterly pure. There is no evil involved in it. The world today has quite lost its sense of purity. And this is one of its curses, which is afflicting all mankind. The human race is impure today, through and through. It's rotten in its mind and heart, and in its action and behavior, therefore. That is why all this violence and fear and confusion, insecurity, and the widespread evil, which is growing and growing. But in total attentiveness, that is out. So, this total attentiveness in the now means that the past is no dead weight upon you. Your mental constructs are dissolved. The mind has become void, in the true sense. Void of the clutter of all sorts of thought forms, confused shapes, ill shapes. Not true to reality shapes. It's become completely void. It is transparent, utterly transparent to the light of reality. Now, this is not just a poetic phrase. It is a state of being and consciousness which, because it is transcendent to what we ordinarily know as being and consciousness, makes us feel that this is nothing. This is, one is afraid of the void, of the emptiness. It undoubtedly is no thing. It's nothing in that sense. But it is unfettered creative energy in its purity. And it is no longer your mind. In total attentiveness. This is the wonderful part of it. It is the universal mind functioning through the living psychophysical organism which is you. To put it in theistic language, it is God functioning through you. It is the unborn the unmade, the unbecome, which has come to light, to actual manifestation, transcendent manifestation, not material manifestation, through you, the material psychophysical being. And you see, in this state, the limiting influence of the unidirectionality of time, the consciousness of existence and the living process of the universe in terms of time and space, unidirectional time and space, is out. All time is suddenly present. Which means, therefore, that what we call the future is also embodied in the immediate now. And how is that future embodied in the immediate now, in terms of time? We saw that the immediate now is the resultant of the total past, the living, as it went through all its transformation process and became the now. And in becoming the now, it holds a potentiality within it, a potentiality for its further development and continuation of a transforming process, which brings it to full fruition, to fulfillment, as we call it. The energy that induces, that draws out this potentiality in the now, is the future. An unknown, mysterious energy. That is why no man can predict the future. In the real sense. It is the unknown, the marvelous. Why? It belongs to the realm of creation, not of procreation. All predictables, and there are certain things which one can predict, yes. You see, all predictables belong to the realm of the mortal, that which is born and dies. Because the human mind, having gathered knowledge of the technique which the living process displays as it undergoes transformation, having gathered that knowledge, a man can see that the likelihood is that these forces in operation will work out that way. And that can be done only within the limited context, the context of mortality. In terms of totality, you can't. It's quite impossible. In terms of totality, everything that has happened and will happen and is happening throughout the universe is happening simultaneously. Take the galaxy which is just coming into being. Take the galaxy which has developed thus far. Take the galaxies which are to be or dying, etc. You see? Which are dying. Well, they are all present simultaneously, aren't they? Take our simple little planet. At this moment, all over the planet, everything that the human race does, feels, thinks, is happening simultaneously. You remember our famous Earth meditation, as we called it? You practice that, it will open your vision in the most marvelous way and remove innumerable illusions and obstacles to your real fulfillment. If you let the mind be quiet and become aware of the whole globe instead of just Forest Hill or this room or something, you will realize, yes, at this very moment, which we call 25 minutes past 5 in the afternoon You see, at this very moment, all over the globe, everything that the human race does, feels, thinks, plans, suffers, enjoys, etc., is happening simultaneously. Somewhere somebody is murdering somebody. Somewhere children are being born continuously, people are dying, people are marrying, people are fighting, people are busy, or they are just frittering away their energies, enjoying themselves as they imagine, and all the rest of it. It's all happening simultaneously. The universe is like that. And in total attentiveness, therefore, in the immediate now, see the meaning of omniscience? It works both ways, in the transcendental sense and even in the material sense. So now, this future is this extraordinary energy which works drawing out the potentiality which is in the now. Don't regard this as metaphysics or something like that. That's of no use to us. We are concerned with living the religious life, which means living as true human beings. Always remember the meaning of the word human. The happy creator. Creator. What sort of a person is creator? What do we learn from Orthodox religion? The one and only happy creator, God. You think of what has been written about God. He's in everlasting bliss. Let us say he, or if you like, let us say she. Doesn't matter which gender you use, or if you like, use both genders. He, she, like Yahweh. That contains the masculine and feminine aspects of the deity simultaneously. Is in bliss, is creator, happy creator. That's the meaning of the word human. So, don't look at this as if it were another kind of philosophy or just a crazy bit of intellectual cobweb spinning. Feel out the significances here of total attentiveness and see how, in the state of total attentiveness, all evil disappears. And when all evil disappears, evil is the thing that we actually know here and now. The good, we don't know. It's a mystery. But if the evil is out, then the natural goodness, perfection, beauty of the whole universe is here now with you and in you.